update.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity. It's always great to come here to this vibrant place. And today I want to talk about some recent work that I've been doing together with Andre Bernevik, Hermann Sierra, Kurt von Kaiserlingen. Juan He actually has been a PSI student, I think, so he's now at Princeton. And so this work that I'm going to talk about is yet unpublished, but I hope we'll put out the papers soon, in a week or so. And it's on Bose condensation in topologically ordered systems. So let me first define the question in some sort of schematic sense that we are interested in. And I apologize, this is the last slide with pretty pictures, so the rest of the talk is going to be a little bit more mathematical. So the problem that we pose is, suppose we have a topologically ordered state, which is a gap ground state at zero temperature, and is characterized by some type of anion excitations that you that it can support, and suppose that one of these anions is a boson, and as a boson it has the possibility to undergo a Bose-Einstein condensation transition. And the question is, what happens? And well, also the question is, why should something interesting happen in such a case? And the reason is that this boson, it could have some non-trivial braiding statistics with the other anions in the theory, and hence it might force the theory to undergo some transition to a new topologically ordered state. And so the fact that the boson condenses means that it essentially goes into the vacuum. It's not there anymore somehow. But then this can have profound impact on the other anions. It can, for example, lead to confinement of some of these anions. And then we have to take these also out of the theory. And the final theory that we end up with is also a topologically ordered state, but it might look very different than the initial one. And so the question is, knowing the initial state and the types of bosons that we want to condense, what can we infer about the final state with this amount of information? And I will present this program in exactly these steps. So we start with an initial theory, which we call A. There is going to be an intermediate theory, T, which still contains these confined excitations. And we are ultimately interested in some final theory, which I'll call U. Okay, so that's the program. Maybe let me illustrate a little bit more what I actually want to think about physically by two examples. So the first example is something that's commonly known to many of us, and that's the toric code. So the toric code is a topologically ordered model of spin 1/2 degrees of freedom on a square lattice, or on the, rather the links of a square lattice, and it's exactly soluble it's the Hamiltonian is defined by these star and plaquette operators, which act with the product of sigma z's and sigma x's on the four bonds surrounding a plaquette and a star, respectively. And these are both projection operators, and they mutually commute. So when I write a Hamiltonian like that, it's exactly soluble because it has an extended number of conserved quantities. And the ground state of this model can be pictured as an equal amplitude superposition of loop excitation loops that are characterized by bonds having, say, a sigma z spin up. Okay, so when I mark all the sigma z up spins by a black line, then I can find closed loops in these ground state in the things that contribute to the ground state. And then we are interested in excitations. There are three types of excitations here. One are the electric excitations, which are just the ends of such a line of spin up bonds. And this defines an E particle. And another excitation is the M particle, which is created by acting with the sigma X operator on a series of bonds like that. And then the end is an M excitation. Okay, so these are the topological excitations, and there's a third one, which is just the product of the two, meaning that you have an E and an M on the same plaquette, essentially. Okay, Now, what does now I want to define a condensation transition. So that's like should be the first example of a condensation transition, and you can induce a condensation by applying an external magnetic field on the system. So if you apply a magnetic field that, for example, goes in the x direction, what happens is that in the large field limit, every bond will have this equal amplitude superposition of up and down spin. And that means essentially that that all the bonds, all the strings, can end everywhere. So that means these electric particles are actually everywhere. So that essentially means they are condensed. They are part of the vacuum. And in turn, these sigma x strings that create the m particles, they now cost energy because they are flipping the field value here. And so at the same time as we condense the E particles, we confine the M particle, and the final theory has nothing left, right? So part is in the vacuum, the other part is condensed, confined. So we are ending up with a trivial theory in this condensing these M excitations in the toric code. Okay, so that's one maybe a little bit an abstract example. Let me give you a second one, which might be more physically appealing. And that is relates to superconductors, chiral superconductors. So we know that in two dimensions, if we gauge a superconductor with a churn number one or a chiral p-wave superconductor, then it has excitations that are, of course, these Bogoliubov quasi-particles that every superconductor has, but more importantly, in the core of the vortex, you have these Majorana anion excitations. So there is a zero energy bound state in the vortex. That's essentially what that says. So these are the excitations in my superconductor. First of all, when I take the Bogoliubov quasi-particle and add it to this vortex, that essentially leaves this vortex as a topological excitation unchanged. And two of these Bogoliubov quasi-particles together can fluctuate in and out of the condensate, so they are essentially a Cooper pair, and they're essentially nothing from the point of view of topological excitations. And now we can ask, what happens if we take two layers of this system? Okay, if they are decoupled in each layer, I can support each of these two excitations independently. But when I start to couple them, the most physical coupling is, I guess, to couple these two Bogoliubov quasi-particles across the layer and to essentially let them also be a Cooper pair or part of the condensate. And that that kind of coupling has immediate consequences on the other excitations in the problem. So, for example, if I have an excitation where I have a vortex and the Majorana states in both layers, if the layers are uncoupled, then I have actually two energy levels, a two-level system, local qubit, if you wish, in this vortex. But as I start to couple them, they actually split in energy, these two states of this flux line. And I should rather think of them as being two separate excitations of my system, I think. Likewise, my excitation with two Bogoliubov quasi-particles will again be part of the condensate, so will be nothing. And maybe one question that one could ask is, what happens if I manage to just put a Majorana in one of the layers, right? What will happen here? And now you get a feeling of, well, I want to go here, but you see that these answers are maybe not so satisfying. They are a little bit, hand waving. Yeah. So you see that I'm not very rigorous on what happens on the right hand side. So the goal of this whole talk and the effort here is to be able to deduce in a mathematically rigorous way what is coming out here, okay, after condensing this boson, this fermions across the two layers. Okay, so that brings me to the outline of the talk. So that's the program for the next 45 minutes. I will give you first the primer on category theory, because that's the language in which we talk about these topologically ordered states. And then I will formulate axioms, or basic assumptions, for this condensation transition. on the basis of which I can prove equations that are leading towards an algorithm for how I obtain the phase after condensation, right? So an algorithm that shows me, you know, that I can go through and I obtain the topological order after the boson has condensed. Maybe I have a short comment on interpretation in terms of conformal field theory of this. And the last part is going to be on a no-go theorem for boson condensation. So I'll be able to show that some bosons actually cannot condense. Okay, that's, I think, also interesting sort of physically. Okay, so but let's start out with what a fusion category is, because that's the kind of language that I'll be using throughout the talk. If you have heard that before, take a chance to check your emails, but this is just one slide, so or two actually. So the basic idea is to have an axiomatic description of the topological quantum field theory by starting off with the assumption that there is a finite number of anion types that that is living in my topological fluid. And the basic characterization is by telling what happens when I fuse two of these anions, what comes out of that. Of course, there have to be another set of anions coming out. So if I fuse A and B, I get a superposition of other anions. And this fusion outcome is characterized by these integer numbers, non-negative integer numbers, NABC, the fusion coefficients. Okay. Now, there are a bunch of you know, conditions that these fusion rules have to satisfy. For one, the vacuum, there is a special particle that we call vacuum, which leaves every other particle unchanged under fusion. And also, every particle has an antiparticle, which I call a bar here. And when it fuses with this antiparticle, there comes out the vacuum plus other stuff. And this can actually be the anion A itself, but it doesn't need to be. These fusion rules should also be commutative and associative. And I can now, given these conditions, I can conveniently define a number associated with every fermion, which is kind of a non-local internal size of the Hilbert space of that anion. It's called the quantum dimension. And it turns out that this thing is coinciding with the largest eigenvalue of the matrix NABC defined like that. So it's derived from these fusion matrices, and for normal abelian anions this is one, and it can be higher than one for more exotic particles. And this quantum dimension. So you see that there is a pictorial representation of the fusion process here, by thinking of this as world lines going up in time of the particles A and B fusing into C. And there is a pictorial representation of what this quantum dimension is. We draw a ring for that. And it's essentially a definition, if you wish, of this picture is this number. This is not only the largest eigenvalue of this. This quantum dimension is not only the largest eigenvalue of this matrix. It turns out that the structure is much more intricate, namely the eigenvector corresponding to this eigenvalue is also the vector made out of all the quantum dimensions for the particles in the theory. And the norm of this eigenvector, so the square sum of all these quantum dimensions, we call the total quantum dimension, which is just a characterization of the theory, if you wish. And then the larger this number, the more complex our topological order is, you know. More particles are there and so on. Okay, so that's a fusion category. When we talk about topological order, we also talk about what happens when you braid particles, when you take them around one another. This structure is not contained here. This structure makes sense only when we talk about a braided fusion category. So we take all what we had before, and now we add a little bit of information, namely what happens when a particle. So one way to represent this information is saying what happens when a particle world line is spinning around itself like that, okay? And resolving this world line into a straight world line, particle just traveling upwards, is done by multiplying with a complex phase that's called the topological spin of the particle. So we twist the particle around itself essentially, and this is, you know, revealing the spin the spin of the particle. And bosons have topological spin one, fermions have spin one half, or as a complex number, it's minus one. And now with this information, we can define two matrices, the modular matrices that are T, which is just a diagonal matrix with all these spins, and the modular S matrix, which is given here in terms of the fusion coefficients and all the spins and the quantum dimensions. And these two matrices are believed to uniquely describe the type of topological order that we have. So these will be the central objects that we'll play with. So they're like square matrices with the size of the the size corresponding to the number of anions in the theory. Okay, so they're unitary for the cases that we are interested in here, and they satisfy further constraints. One of them is this powerful formula due to Verlinde, which relates the S matrix. That's the only thing you need to carry away from this formula. It relates the S matrix to these fusion coefficients again, and is therefore a very powerful constraint, because these fusion coefficients need to be non-negative integers, otherwise it doesn't make sense. Okay, so that was a braided fusion category. Just to close this, let me note that the vacuum has quantum dimension one and spin one as well, so this is trivial in every respect. Okay, just to come back to our two examples, which will follow throughout the talk. The first one is the toric code, and the fusion rules are given here. And importantly, E cross M is this fermion F. All these are abelian particles. The quantum dimensions are one. E and M are bosons. Hence, we could, we were able to condense E, right? And the F is a fermion. The other one was the chiral superconductor, and here, the critical fusion rule is sigma cross sigma is 0 plus psi. That's the one of the Ising TQFT. And the choice, consistent choice of spins is written down here. And you see also that the quantum dimension of sigma is larger than 1. So this is a non-abelian particle. And also psi is a fermion, as should be, right? That's a Bogoliubov quasi-particle. Okay, so that's just like so that you get a feeling of what this looks like in these two examples. Okay, now back to condensation. So let me reformulate now with this language at hand the problem that I stated on the very first slide. So I want to start with a category, a fusion category, braided fusion category, and identify some bosons with the vacuum. Okay. And then I want to derive a new consistent fusion category T, which respects all the axioms of fusion category that I presented. And to do that, I invoke a mapping from the particles in A, little a's here, to a linear superposition of particles in T with integer coefficients. And these integer coefficients, NAT, not negative, these will be the main players for the rest of the talk. So this little N matrix is kind of crucially important. Okay, so this is the main map, the restriction map we call it, and this is the main map that does this condensation. And then once we have T, we check which of the anions in T are confined. We remove them from the theory and we are left over with the remaining anions that form a braided fusion category U. Okay, so that's the program. Now, I didn't tell you why that works or how it works. That will come next, okay? And of course, I don't wanna give the impression that we invented this. This is a long story that started way back in mathematics and moved towards physics. Actually, Jidun, who's here, has contributed to that in translating from math to physics. And an important paper that shaped, I guess, the physics world understanding of this is by Bice and Slingerland, which gave sort of a heuristic prescription on this condensation transition here in this paper. Okay, so, but what we want to do here is we want to give some basic assumptions in terms of algebraic relations between the numbers that I have presented so far, the quantum dimensions, and so on, and derive algorithm that allows you to actually go through this program and find the phase after condensation. So let, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to the question. It's a very good question. Actually, we discussed this morning about that, and you know, it's not, I think we it's not known. But all the cases, I mean, I've not, of course, otherwise I would give the answer. I have no counterexample, of course. I have always, for all the cases that I know, there is a unique answer, but of course that doesn't tell you anything. Yeah, so that's open. So there are two sets of assumptions. One concerns fusion, one concerns braiding. The physical assumption on fusion is that this restriction map should commute with the fusion. So fusion I have once in the theory A and once in the theory T. So the fusion coefficients I have in A and in T, okay? Or more pictorially, suppose this is time and the condensation happens at some point in time, I want this diagram essentially to give me the same as this diagram. So if I first condense and then fuse in T, it should be the same as if I first fuse in the theory A and then I condense. In terms of an equation, this is it. So what enters are the fusion coefficients here and these little ends that describe this restriction map, okay? So this is the first assumption that we make, this equation, okay? And the second assumption, so, okay, let me say that this has already some implications. It actually applies that it fixes essentially the quantum dimensions of all the particles after the condensation. Here they are given in terms of the old quantum dimensions and some overall factor that says how large essentially the vacuum is, or how many particles go in the vacuum. Okay. Second assumption is on braiding, and this is a little more subtle. So what you would like is that you would like to say physically when I braid in the A theory and then do the condensation, the outcome should be the same as if I was braiding in the new U theory. In terms of diagrams, one would write such a diagram here for a braiding in the U theory, but let me motivate that. So essentially, before I showed you a diagram that looked like this for the braiding, right? But you can, to get a number, you would, you know, actually close this up to get a closed amplitude, right? And now, if we condense or if we apply this restriction map, this world line of the T particle is replaced by the sum over A NAT, and these restriction coefficients, and now we can resolve this diagram in the old theory by just, you know, writing instead of this, we can take our definition of the topological spin and put theta A here, and then we are left with this, and this was again our quantum dimension. Okay, this closed ring, that was the definition of our quantum dimension. So this part of the equation is just written again here, theta A, NAT, and dA, and this should be actually equal to this thing done in the new theory, if that anion is in U, so if it's not confined. If it is confined, this diagram cannot really be resolved because I don't know how I can braid this thing. This is not part of a braided fusion category. And in this case, we assume that this sum here evaluates to zero. This is an assumption which we can actually prove from weaker assumptions in some special cases, like condensate only contains abelian bosons and some other simple examples. In general, however, we don't know how to prove that, so we have to assume it. Anyway, so this is what is in the frame here, is the second assumption of our underlying our... A is the theory that I start off with. T is the theory which is a fusion category but has confined particles. And then U is a braided fusion category, which is T without the confined particles.
How do you define confined particles?
This is the definition. This is my definition. This sum for a particle t evaluates to zero, then it's confined.
Okay, so
but I mean, physically, it means that it has some non-trivial braiding with the particles in the vacuum. So it does see, if I have a particle that has, if I have that boson that I want to condense, right? If I have another particle that has non-trivial braiding with this boson, and I condense this boson, then this other particle has a problem, because it would have non-trivial braiding with part of the vacuum, right? And that is physically what is behind this the confined, making this a confined particle. Is that roughly giving you some intuition? That's the definition. That's the mathematical definition, and the physical sort of intuition. That's what I tried to give you. If the boson has non-trivial braiding with a particle, then essentially this thing confines.
So the confined manuals, they still have fusion.
That's right. They still have fusion. Yes.
And the fusion is still symmetric.
That's not. Actually, I'm not sure about that. I'm not 100% sure. So if you look in Bayes' paper, I think they say it doesn't need to be. You mean whether it's commutative, right? But I don't know whether I actually know a case where it is not. Do you know a case? It doesn't have to be according to, but do you know an example where it failed?
Well, you can see that just the group algebra of any non-companic group, there the fusion is not commutative.
Original category, everything is symmetric, even though it's not.
Yeah, you can form the common level of the set, and there the anions, the fusion will be symmetric.
Yeah, no, I was more wondering like whether there is a concrete condensation transition where you would see that happening. Probably one can construct
but
something.
But didn't assume.
No, they didn't assume. Yeah. I didn't really investigate. So you'll see that we'll actually kind of sidestep this theory T. So we'll kind of do this in what I propose on the next slide. So I didn't really study much this intermediate step. It's just a part for the derivation I needed, but I can sort of bypass it.
So in terms of the example, can you get the original fusion category from the quantum double through a condensation?
Sorry.
So he was mentioning you start with a fusion category and get its quantum double.
Uh-huh.
It's the commutative gradient. But
yeah.
But imagine if you start with this quantum double version.
Can you break it down to its original under condensation? I don't know. I don't think so. That would change. It would. So this, for example, preserves the chiral central charge, which would not happen in that case, right? So, yeah. Sounds like you had a problem.
So
question.
Many-to-one net.
Yeah.
And is the idea the corner of the net is the particle that are condensed?
So the
corner of the net.
Oh yeah. Also the yes, that's right. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Is that? Yeah. Then it's right. Then it's exactly that. Yeah. I was not sure what he meant by kernel. I thought he meant maybe stuff that goes away. This. So there is a vacuum, so you put the vacuum up here and then you ask, which particles go to the vacuum? So this is the condensate.
Right.
These A's for which this is non-zero is the condensate.
There's some, what is the confined particle?
you can distinguish on the basis of the mapping itself, you cannot distinguish.
Right. I think it's more tricky than that, because you can have some large non-abelian particle with some large dimension condensing, and what it means, it will split into a vacuum and some other particle, so it's...
Yeah.
Can I ask, your criterion here, does this translate into some criterion that I could write down for the S matrix?
Yeah, in one, that's exactly the next slide, yeah, that's right. So we want to actually solve something on the computer, I mean, like with Mathematica or so, like a linear algebra problem. So we want to reformulate this. I mean, we want to take these assumptions and find some matrix relations that I can solve. So how we're going to do that is, of crucial importance is actually, it turns out, this a matrix that I can compose out of this little n by summing over only the unconfined particles in T, okay? And if I use this matrix, which is an integer matrix with positive numbers, symmetric, I can show that this commutes with S and T. And then furthermore, I can show that this equation holds, where this is my little n here. And the S tilde and the T tilde are the modular matrices of the new phase of U after condensation. So this has S tilde and T tilde. And to find these things is really the goal of the game, right? This is what we know what the theory after condensation is. So these are the equations that we want to solve. And what we propose is the following way of solving it. So you start with theory A, and this has a modular matrix S and T. And the first thing you should do is you should solve these equations here for m, constraining it to non-negative symmetric integer m. And m11 should be 1. That just says that the vacuum maps to the vacuum, okay, under the condensation. And then you have a set of solutions, finite set, actually. And you can try for every solution to decouple it or to write it as n and transpose. That's just the definition of m, right? So it's all for this little n. This is, in principle, a hard problem because it's integer matrix factorization. But typically here we are not talking about too large matrices. Maybe you want to study systems with 100 anions or so, but it's still possible without any... tweaking. And then once you have the n, you can attack this equation. Of course, this equation alone would be enough, right? This is the ultimate problem. But if I initially looked at this equation, both n and s tilde are unknowns, right? So there's no chance that I can effectively solve that. But going through this routine, I have now the n, and I can solve for s tilde only. That's the only unknown. So this is the way, so we propose doing this. And then when we have a solution for S tilde, we still need to check whether this is a consistent, choice for a modular tensor category. So in particular, checking that Verlinde formula gives you non-negative integers for the fusion coefficients is a very powerful constraint. And then you pretty much know that you have succeeded. And this is a valid modular tensor category. What I'm saying is I don't have to solve subject to these additional constraints because this looks like a horrible constraint. But I get a finite set of solutions here, and I can just check every one. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be a huge set. There's maybe like handful of solutions at most, and I can check this for every one of them and discard some. I don't need to impose these constraints to get a finite set of solutions. This already comes from here.
Do you ever find solutions on the top that don't satisfy the Verlinde
formula? Yes, actually, that's the funny thing. So we have examples where up to here, everything works. This thing is unitary, S squared is equal to ST cubed, everything. But Verlinde gives you -1/2, something like that. It's very funny, but it happens. So this thing needs to be checked. That's a good question.
Could you say one thing? So you have two topological orders with different S and T's,
mm-hmm.
and you want to classify gap boundaries between
mm-hmm.
them. But CFT arguments, you can get similar relations.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So classify different kind of gap boundaries. the different.
Yeah, then you get right away this this equation, right? Because then you have S and S tilde already given, and you're solving for n.
Exactly.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So there can be many different solutions to that.
That's
what
true.
You said earlier was unique.
Okay. So now, yeah. So maybe I should be a bit careful what I say is unique. Given an n, I think. Sorry. No. So what I think is unique is if I have these things specified. So if I specify what goes in the condensate, there is a unique S tilde. If I specify the first row of this N matrix, essentially, I think there is a chance that there is a unique S tilde. That's how I interpreted Max's question. And so given a condensate, is S tilde unique and T tilde? And this is, I don't have a counterexample, but I also don't know whether it's true. But there's a chance it is. What is certainly not true is given S and T, and S, I mean, there are many ways to condense in principle. That's for sure. And even this is not unique. Given an S and T and an S tilde and T tilde, there could be many fundamentally different ways of, you know, the N that does this can be very different, involving bosons of different quantum dimension and so on, not just permutation symmetries or so. Really, yeah. So okay, good. Okay, so now we are, well, we are good. Let me go quickly through the examples that I had cited, just to tell you how simple it is. So this is the toric code. Of course, these are really baby examples, but for illustration, so this is the S and T matrix of the toric code. If you look, for example, for solutions of this equation, there are actually exactly two. They look like that. This is the M matrix. And now you can, you know, go and try to find the N matrix that does this. And it turns out it's just a vector, of course. And this vector, taking the outer or product, gives you this matrix. And likewise with this vector. And this corresponds to condensing either the E particle or the M particle. And then, since this is just the 1/4 matrix, the final theory is trivial, so I don't even need to solve for S tilde and T tilde. So that's almost too trivial of an example. But you see that already here, like there's just these two solutions, so I don't get like spurious stuff on the way. And the other example of the double layer Ising is working just as well. So you don't need to look too long into what the S and T matrix is, but you know here they are. I mean, this is single layer and double layer is a direct product of the two. If I look for solutions for M commuting with S, there is a unique solution. It's given here. This is this M matrix. And now to find the N is, you know, you can always, you can see it by eye what the N is. Here it is. The only problem is that this two I have to resolve into two ones. And that's the thing that Max mentioned earlier. That there is splitting going on. So this two is the particle sigma sigma. Sigma sigma is quantum dimension two. I mean, you have this essentially my double vortex sigma in each layer. And this has quantum dimension two. And what happens is that this splits into two particles of quantum dimension one under this restriction map. So that's the only place where the sum is actually a sum over, when I wrote A goes to sum over t n a t t, then here, you know, there's really two contributions. And so this is the n, the only n that does this. And you see that the condensate is really one and the psi psi, that last particle here, psi psi. So voila. And then you can solve for this last equation, and it turns out there's a unique solution, and this is exactly the c equal to the example from Kitaev's 16-fold way, where he, you know, classifies all superconductors, all chiral superconductors, and it's really the theory for a gauged chiral D-wave superconductor, if you wish. Okay, so it's a unique answer, and you can go through all of Kitaev's 16-fold way. It's always unique, the condensation that you get. You always go to the, you know, nu equal to c theory, except of course for 16 layers. There you have the choice to either condense to the toric code or straightforwardly to nothing, right? Because the toric code can be condensed to nothing. So that's, you know, how you can see that from condensation. Okay, let me make two or three small comments. One is actually that what we already discussed, you can find spurious solutions, but the other direction is a strong direction. Every possible condensation has to show up as a solution of my algorithm. So I can find spurious stuff, but it's, you know, when I don't find a solution, then that means also there is none, right? This stuff conserves the chiral central charge modulo 8 under condensation. And the quantum dimension in going from a theory A to a theory U is always decreasing. Actually, the amount by which it decreases, the quotient of the quantum theories is given by the quantum dimension of the vacuum in a way. And so that you can think of this as maybe a D theorem, that this always decreases. Okay, so in the interest of time, I will skip the relation to CFTs and go ahead and talk about bosons that cannot condense. Okay, so, well, why would that happen, that there are bosons that cannot condense? Let me give you the simplest example, and that happens, or one simple example, and that is in Fibonacci theory. So, here's the fusion rules. So Fibonacci is sort of the second simplest topological quantum field theory that we can think of after the semion. It has just one non-trivial particle, tau, and the fusion rule is tau, because tau is vacuum plus tau. Okay, so it's non-abelian. And the S matrix looks like that, where this phi is the golden ratio, and the spin of tau is 4 pi over 5. Okay, well, there cannot be any condensation because there's no boson in this thing, right? But in the spirit of this layering that we have for the superconductor, we could ask what happens if we have 5 layers of this theory, then we have a boson, namely the tau, like every layer we put a tau, and then we have this thing, the spin is just the product of these spins of everybody, so we have 4 pi, so it's a boson, right? Okay, that thing. Now, we could ask, well, can this thing condense? And with the equations that I've just presented on the last slides, we can actually show in a very quick way that this cannot condense. If it condensed, then there must be a solution to this equation, M commuting with S. And we can look at a certain element of this, the vacuum with the particle with has only one tau in one layer. And if we do that, I don't need to walk you through the algebra, but if you do that, on the right-hand side, we obtain a sum over positive numbers, quantum dimensions, and these M, the M elements of this M matrix, okay, something positive. And on the left-hand side, essentially, there comes to aid that to our aid that this S matrix has a negative entry here. There is the left-hand side evaluates to this thing. So phi is larger than one, so this here, this number qualifies like how many times does this boson appear in the vacuum. And if I want to have a condensation, this number needs to be at least one. But you see that this is negative if that number is one, so you know, we know that there cannot be a non-trivial solution to this equation. Okay, so we've shown that there is no condensation possible. There's no condensation. This thing cannot condense. Okay. Now this is actually not a new result. In fact, you can show that for any number of Fibonacci layers, there is no condensation possible, even though you have like tons of bosons. Everything that has a multiple of 5 times times a tau is a boson. And here is a paper, like 30 pages in the Journal of Algebra, that proves this, and our formalism can also prove it in one column. We can do a little more. We actually can show that Fibonacci is what people call SO3 level 3. We can generalize this proof to any SO3 level k with odd k. There is never a condensation possible. So in this whole family of theories, there's no condensation possible, even though you have tons of bosons. And I think that since I didn't tell you about CFT, I should skip that part. And before concluding, let me just give you a no-go theorem that's a little more general, that doesn't, you know, just tell you a specific theory, but you know, just relies on some basic assumptions that you will see and tells you that no condensation is possible in any number of layers. So suppose you have a modular tensor category A, and it satisfies the following three properties. Every particle in A is its own antiparticle. That's not a very strong constraint. Actually, any theory that we've talked about so far satisfies that. All particles have quantum dimension larger than one, except for the vacuum. And if any two anions, A and B, have conjugate spin, complex conjugate spin, then they have to have different quantum dimension. If that is true, then there is no condensation allowed in any number of layers of A. I mean, in A itself and also in any number of layers. And yeah, so that's something that we can prove just based on this condensation formalism that I introduced. Okay, so that brings me to my conclusions. So what I've presented is an axiomatic and algebraic formulation of the condensation problem that is numerically tractable. So you can put these few matrix equations into Mathematica, and it will spit out for your favorite SNT matrix, will spit out all the possible condensations that you can have. It is also useful analytically. I showed you an example in this non-condensability proof that, you know, you can use these equations also to do something with pencil and paper. And let me just mention some future directions. So I guess if you, you know, towards the goal of understanding topological order not only in two but in three dimensions, people are studying layer constructions of states. And I think condensation is a way to build these layer constructions. I mean, there are many questions on how practically to do that, but in particular in non-Abelian theories, I think this might be interesting to look at. There is a problem of whether you can, how you understand this in non-modular theories, whether you can condense stuff, even though we don't really know what it means physically, but whether there is such a thing as a fermion condensation. And things like what Heider was mentioning, the bulk boundary correspondence or the problem of boundaries of different topological states could also be understood, or, you know, I mean, work has been done already on this, but I think there's also still many open questions on how condensation relates to different possible boundaries of topological order. Okay, with that, I thank you very much for your attention.
Your Noble theorem actually may mean that once you condense those particles, you become gapless.
You cannot gap it. That might be So as you notice, that energetics didn't play a role here, right? And that might be an interesting.
Because you can write down the wave function.
Well, mathematically, you just cannot condense them, because mathematically this condensation is equivalent to this Frobenius algebra with certain conditions, and such that it is well defined in algebra object. There is a closure relation. It means you have a product that can be defined on this algebra. And in those cases, you can show that the algebra doesn't exist.
Yeah, but that makes sense only when you have a gap.
Exactly. The algebra is by definition a kind of description of a gap's topological phase.
Yeah, you can.
So
you can
one possible
that.
Interpretation is, you know, you try to drive this condensation term and you can never get into that gap phase, but you could well get to a critical.
In other words, if you want to condense that boson in such an example, you will have to condense everything else. But you will not be able to condense everything else because lots of things are not mutual local with each other.
Yeah, but that's essentially, again, maybe an indication of a gapless phase, right? Because, because if it was mutually, I think that might be a good way to think about the problem, actually.
Phase. I mean, you know, we talk about like condensing semions all the time. You know, just take like a transcendence theory coupled to some complex boson. It's just that, you know, this formalism maybe doesn't give a, you know, simple.
The question is then how to extend it, though, right? I guess that's maybe.
Well, so one thing that I think is probably true is, so there's two different ways that you could, there's two different scenarios. You could think about this as being a statement about like CFTs on the edge, of things, and I think if you view them as like statements about boundaries between topological phases, the statement is probably that you can't like gap that 1D system. But if you viewed it as a 2D system, then you could imagine the kind of thing that you're thinking about, where you know something condenses in a non-trivial flux or something.
I guess part of the issues we're trying to, when you talk about like PTFTs and boundary between them, here we're kind of trying to guess what one of the sides is, right? Like you. I guess
you want me to draw something?
Yeah, you're layering A. I mean, there's like A on one side and U on the other side, and you're actually trying to figure out what U might be so that the boundary is.
Yeah, so actually, that's a question. So, like, in the case that there's no, you know, that you would think there's a boson that you can condense, but there's nothing, does that mean that that's an ungappable boundary? Like, that there's no other phase that I can put there where that boundary is
gapped?
That
phase would be smaller in some sense.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. But like in particular, I can't condense to get to the back.
But that cannot be. Oh, you say it's not a gap boundary then. I mean, it's clearly
yeah.
there can be boundaries of a system like there's non-gappable bosons and they have a boundary with the vacuum, right? I mean that the boundary exists, but you're saying it has to be gapless. I mean, that there are other criterion for this, right? The chiral central charge already can prevent this, right? So, but I guess not all of these theories have. I mean, you could find Fibonacci with appropriate number of layers, and it has chiral central charge 8, right? So that would not be an obstruction as such, but yeah, it could be an extra.
See, you started with the example Sartori for the superior superconductors, where the anions could be localized.
Yes.
So in principle, I can imagine writing down wave functions in coordinate representation. So where I will have the symmetric property when I interchange orbital positions. Now, is there any difficulty in writing that? In the sense, you cannot write it because you are violating some global property of the wave function. Because I can close my eyes and write down formally the wave function for bosons, assuming that these anions, we call them as bosons.
Yeah.
They have some more property other than bosons,
mm-hmm.
which is what is preventing condensation.
Yeah.
So how is it?
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think that I have a very good answer to the question, but I think the question is a good one. Because what I don't understand fully is like what is the physical meaning of this non-condensability, I think. And maybe like something like that might help understand.
Because these are all objects, you know. Like in the case of Haldane-Halperin hierarchy, quantum
object.
You can construct anions, then write down wave functions for them consistently for quasi-particles, and then keep going up.
I wouldn't even think that I understand the condensation transition in the other general cases on the level of a wave function. I think the ones that you cited certainly, but suppose I write a more Reed state for bosons in two layers and I want to condense the psi particle that I did here, right? What do I have to do to that wave function? I don't know.
Carry something else, which is what is preventing you from bringing irrational dimension. It's carrying.
That's right. But that, so it must. It has to do with this stupid irrational. You know, I don't know number, right? It's not like, for example, the square root of 2 example of the Ising. There you can do, right? But here, no power is ever an integer, so maybe that is something that plays into that. I don't know. It's all good questions, actually.
Okay. So, stop there. Let's ask them. Seems like
Thanks.